view of what we have been doing, because it started with prenatal brain formation in the womb, which is a very special area that I am into. And I have my brain with me. The reason I made this was to show how very beautiful it was. I go to schools and do this program, and they really want to find out all about it, but the description of the brain is sometimes very unattractive. So I thought if I made it out of some very special material, the beauty of it would come through visually, and then we could talk about how fantastic the parts were. We started with the first class with the neonatal brain, which looks very much like this. I mean, the whole little fetus with the head very, very close to the stomach. And there was a little, no, I should do it this way, then it'll show better. And the form is like this, and then it starts to grow. It doesn't go that fast. And the brain formation begins like in the third month. You can actually see some tiny little tracings in the cranium. And the dendrites, none of the connectors, of course, are not there. By the ninth month of life, in the first class, I did go through these parts very with precise attention to the development of the fetus, to say that the programming genetically is that in the third and fourth month of life, the little fetus is ready to do some exercises that they are programmed to do, and when the mother feels that there are some very energetic goings on there, it's not random at all. The fetus knows that they should practice reflexes that they will need when they are born to survive. Now, my dear friend who's been to every session, I'm just doing kind of an overview, Ion.
So the mother signals to the baby inside that these things need to be learned?
No, God has programmed this little fetus to do what it's supposed to do. This is the miracle of birth, is that before we are born, we know what we are about. And within those few months before birth, this little fetus has to accomplish certain kinds of movement, which you see when the infant is born, and they're called the reflexes. One of them that the mother feels practically the rest of the months, and on almost the first movement, will be the reflex, which goes like this. You know, the little foot goes out and the arm comes up. And when the baby is born, the Moro reflex is very evident. When the little infant is startled, they will do this. You know, they will shoot up. Then there's a tonic neck reflex where the head goes back like this. And then there's also a Landau where the body curves around. And then it also goes into a very closed fetal position. These are to survive the onset of when we are born, all of the tremendous differences in the environment that might startle the baby. And they're given all these little curl up and ready to, you know, it's just fascinating. And the real problem is that if these reflexes do not submit to other neurological processes growing in the spinal column and hang on, then the child will have problems later on, like in the fifth, sixth, and seventh year of life. And we're just finding out this through research that's been done in Chester, England. Dr. Blythe and his partner, who is now his wife, Sally Goddard, have studied for the past 15 years the visual seeing reflexes in children of the ages of 5, 6, and 7 who have problems in learning. And the reflex is hanging on because they are neurophysiologists. They know that those reflexes should be gone. And they wrote a book called A Window into a Child's Mind, which is fantastic because it has pictures of all the babies in the reflexes, listing when they should be gone, between 3 and 6 months. 9 months is quite late. And then on the other side will be a column of the the outward appearances and the difficulties the child will have. Some reflexes will show clumsiness and stumbling, and with the Landau still there. Others, the Moro will agitation, hyperactivity, things like that will show if that's left over. And every reflex that is left will have some indication later on in the years when the child should be able to process more information, when they get into a cognitive state of learning, then these things show up because of the stress. So we now know that here comes the first year of life is so vital, because if, and this was the basis of my wanting to say that the natural way that God wanted us to begin our years on earth without all the entrapments that we see, like wind-up swings and walkers, you know, jumpers, and what are some of the other things? Oh, the curved holders, you know, that babies are put in for quite a length of time, doesn't allow for that neural stimulation on the spinal column. If a baby is an infant is laid on a firm, hard surface on their backs, they will do their wonderful, wonderful exercises. They'll kick their little legs like this, and their arms will go a mile a minute, and they'll straighten out, and then they'll pull up again. And this is what we need to stimulate the spinal column to get rid of the reflexes. Now we are putting children into these other kinds of holding places that doesn't allow for that kind of stimulation. So we dwelt on that quite a bit, the first and second lesson. Then we got up to that sixth and seventh year, and we were talking about other things that happen in the brain. The fact that, of course, everybody knows that a child's brain doesn't have the connections that over the corpus callosum, which is this little bridge here between the left and right hemispheres, this corpus callosum is not yet formed in an infant, and it takes actually more than 2 years before it becomes totally ready to allow for that neural activity to go back and forth. And then one reason we want to have both sides of the brains cooperating is because that's the way we problem solve. Our left brain thinkers can have their kind of criteria for looking at problems. The right brain thinker has his way, but we need both sides before we can really solve problems rapidly with good intentions. So this is something that's not formed yet. The fascinating thing is, I told people yesterday, because we were talking about teenagers, that some of the brainal, in the limbic system, the brainal growth doesn't actually complete its positive maturation until 20 years of age. And this has to do with teenagers having to make quick decisions, having to be able to analyze things, you know, and solve problems. That's why we need mentors. That's why we need to have guidance at that time. That's why we can't expect them to really be overall in control of their lives. So we went through, each class was the infant, then the 5, 6-year-old and 7-year-old, where cognitive processing starts. We talked about, one of my real concerns is that we are bringing academic learning farther and farther down to younger and younger ages, because the actual work that you used to do in second grade, some of the kindergartens are having now at the end of kindergarten. We are hurrying academics on quicker to very young children. But physiologically, the child has many things to complete, such as the one that's special to me is vision development. The visual system doesn't complete total maturation till they're between 7 and 8 years old. It's still formative. They're still trying to have fusion and bilaterality and all the other things that help them to see a perfect letter or a perfect picture. If you don't have fusion, which is that bone between your eyes, extends from here back into your cranium, you have one eye getting the dots and this eye getting the dots. That's all you get this way from vision. Then it crosses over midbrain and goes to the two sides of the occipital lobe back here. I can show you in here. That's the cerebellum. Actually, it's in the topmost cortex here. Back here, there's an occipital lobe where vision becomes what you look at, what you actually see. The dots go in the eyes, in the front of the head. The eyes are extensions of the brain. It's the only thing that you can actually see of your brain. Then the dots come in, cross over here. Back here is where it's information processed, where all the other things that add to what you see come together through many of the limbic system's abilities here, where taste and smell and all those other wonderful modalities will help you see what you're looking at. The bone here, the child has not yet had a complete visual system, because the crossover takes one part of development, and then the occipital lobe gets ready to have its information process when the child has used enough tactile information, touching what's out there in the world, smell, what they've smelled, what they experience. Then the picture makes sense. And only then, when we have some modalities involved, do we get a good picture. So that hasn't actually allowed us to have the complete picture. If you don't have fusion, and a child will look at the central word in a line of words, and there happens to be an H, for instance, which is something I use as an example, it's easy. The little part that connects this line of the H and the short line where the hump goes, the hump will be missing. See, everything in mid-sight won't be there. And a lot of children in kindergarten do not see all of a letter, and they don't know that it doesn't exist, and they can't understand why they can't get it, you know, why they can't get on with reading. The ability to have the maturation of vision depends a lot on movement, how much movement this child has experienced coming along to the school age time. Many countries in Europe and Japan, until just recently, did not start this learning process, this kindergarten, until 7 years. And seven, the number seven, goes along with the chronological age that these things are supposed to have maturated. So we are having children come to kindergarten, the very tender ages, you know, five, without their physiological parts ready for it, which is really sad. But a lot of mothers want children to read, and they think if they read fast and first, everything will be okay. Some children are actually, children are malleable. They want to please, and they will go ahead and they will try to do this, and that's fine, but in third and fourth grade, and this is what our research is based on, all of a sudden these bright readers will have a problem. And I have many parents call me and say, they were the best readers in first grade, and now they want to put them, they're in the end of third grade, they want to put them in a special class, special education class, because their reading has, you know, diminished so, and they're not paying attention, and they're not this and that. And I'll say, well, actually, this started back in kindergarten. It takes 2.5 to 3 years for vision to regress enough to come up with a problem. And then the child will have prescription glasses and will be able to bring the vision back to where they can take on the tasks that they're supposed to do. So that was part of our years of 5, 6, and 7. And then we went on until we got into the early teens, where we have, I read a poem that was quite sad about the many children that have the problems they have. And then there is the other kind that have parents like you and the kind that are here at Holden that have had a good beginning and have had access to knowing about the Lord who takes each one of them very special in his sight and has a plan for them, as is in the Proverbs, that I have a plan for you. There are so many that do not have that. And we as a family of God should be concerned with all children. So if ever we can reach out to one, that's what we should do. It's a very big problem. And yesterday I did tell a story that was in a fantastic book that was in the library about, did you ever hear the story about the king and his advisor that were sitting in a high, someplace having honey on their rice or something, can't remember exactly, but the king wasn't paying attention and a bit of the honey dropped on the windowsill, and the advisor said, but I'll clean that up. And the king said, no, it's not our problem, they'll clean it up. But the honey run over and dropped on the ground, and then immediately a little ant went over to lick up the honey, and then along come a little creature that ate the ant, and then another, I think it was the cat that ate the creature. And then the advisor said, there's a lot going on down there. And the king says, well, don't worry. And then it got bigger and bigger. And then a dog came along to fight with a cat. And then the dog's owner came out there and berated the cat's owner. And the cat's owner did the same to the dog. And pretty soon there was a big, big ruckus down there. And the advisor said, I think something's happening down there. Maybe we should go down and take care of it. And the king said, no, it's not our problem. Somebody else down there will take care of it. And it really became worse because more people came that were friends of the cat's owner and more for the dog. And of course you can see what entailed then was a great big battle. And along came the police that were called out. And when they heard the stories, some of them took one side and some took the other. And the advisor kept saying, we should go down there and see what we can do. And of course, the same thing was said, it's not our problem. And it did end up with a war, you know, some kind of a war. But it's so ridiculous. We have had problems for so long, and we have multiple ways to go about it. And we can all think from a Christian point of view that a multitude of children do not have any kind of solace. They can't take their problems to Jesus, and they can't have a friend like I was fortunate enough to have all my life. There doesn't seem to be anywhere to go if parents aren't there to care for them, to be listening to them. If the advisors in the schools are competent, but they are extremely busy with many, many children. So we have a situation. And now we're looking for a solution. But I think this started after the Second World War in the biggest intent. And I think that was because of the disruption of the family, where the mothers were in this, many, many of them went to war jobs. And that was the beginning of a real beginning for daycare centers. And so it has become more and more so that there are a multitude of daycare centers, and most of them are directed by women without male components. So the total amount of children now from one-parent families, the mother is the model without the other partner. So these little children in daycare, when it's vital to have both parent models, sees only one and grow up in that ignema of not really seeing the whole picture. So it started long ago, and we really were too much about going on with our life after the war, and many people have really put most of the emphasis on the fact that that has created the dilemma of the beginnings of what we are in now. But now, tonight, we're on the other end of the brain, where we're all together. which the brainstem. The cerebellum is where temperature control is, and now every bit of brain research that comes along shows that there are many more activities going on in every section than we ever dreamed about. When I was a nurse before I was married, we studied about the brain, but it was pretty factual. And this did this, and this part did that. Now we find that it's multiple kinds of functions that practically all the brain parts of the brain have. This is called the limbic system. This is a thalamus on each side, which isn't really connected in the brain, but I had to hook it together to keep it here. And this fits over here, and this is the pituitary gland, which is the most important gland in your body, which used to be that this is a growth controller, but now it has other functions that feed back into the limbic system with information. And this is the two little parts that come around here. Aren't they beautiful? This is the hippocampus that's supposed to look like a little seahorse on each side. That has a lot to do with emotions as well as movement activities. And the little acorn-like features here are called amygdalas. Anyway, amygdalas, there's different ways to pronounce that. Getting bigger. And that is that internal part where all the sensations and all the modalities feed information into this particular innermost part of your brain to be able to give you some of your highest kinds of functioning. And this is the gray matter, which has the corpus callosum, the left and right hemispheres, and here comes the cortex, 12 yards of material I stuffed tubing, and I have pearls of wisdom in there, a couple of them, which comes along with time. And this goes on top. And where you see the brightest part, I tried to, and it's probably not as much as it should be, as I'm speaking now, because we're ultra high frequency beings. The energies within the brain are that high in the voltage that the brain is lighting up in the areas as I am speaking, in the language areas, which now they're saying comes in four times as many parts as they ever thought it did before. In the end, as some scientists believe, the brain is a totally integrated system. And then there's more than that, because next week I wanted to do the body-brain connection, which we now know is really functional because of one woman that has scientifically proven, Candace Pert, who is a neurophysiologist, I think her title's even longer than that, but has found the linkage between the molecules in the brain and the lingads and the little parts that hook onto different organs, the messages that are received through these molecular, this connection, this communication system, can or cannot affect different parts of your body. So that long ago, the first, I don't know if any one of you have read Deepak Chopra's, the East Indian gentleman who wrote the book about healing through the mind. There have been many books about the healing brain. He wrote the foreword for this woman's book and said, finally, he waited years to have someone that would scientifically prove the linkage between the mind-brain, the body and the brain. And that's, I think, the way God wanted us to see ourselves, as having the potential to really have a lot to do with our health and well-being. And there are many factors that really go against this. I mean, our environment and our intake of all the food that we eat, and the world situation, the different kinds of stress that we receive, all those can be totally influential on our thinking process, and the way we relate mind-body connections. Come up to Holden and you don't hear the traffic, and you eat wonderful food, and you smell the air, and you see the beauty of God, and your mind-body connection can be fantastic. But when we go back to our habitats, wherever we are, it's not quite that pure anymore. So we have a bit of problem in trying to get to that state where we really can have a good communication system.
Can I ask a question on that? The woman who did the brain research, is that that concept of, like, if you think something, like if you have a hurting finger, if you can almost will your finger to feel better? Like if you, by thinking or prayer, the power of prayer?
All of that is part of it. It's just like I took biofeedback, where you have machinery attached to you so that you're thinking, and they always start with hot and cold. You can bring your temperature down several degrees, or you can raise your temperature by your imagery and your whole concentration on those particular, whether you want to make your temperature lower or get higher. That's been proven. Prayer, of course, because it really conditions the mind. It brings you in touch with a source of healing simply by you releasing all of your tension, releasing all of your cares, putting it in the hands of God, and so you have a clear mind. And that would bring you to a place where you could be able to work on, you know, this particular place or that. In Texas, they have a center which uses, Dr. Bressler started this, from UCLA, where there's a pain control center, and they have patients there who have cancer, and the ratio of cure has been phenomenal, and it has caused us to look at this very seriously, that we have power to do that. But there are some wonderful, wonderful people that have tried and failed. So there are some ways or reasons why that can't always come about. But this is very new. This is something new in our development. And the East Indian people and some of the other Eastern countries have used this kind of process and have more ability, because they were trained this way from very young. I'm not saying about curing diseases, but in controlling temperature and doing those kinds of things with the hemostasis of the body. So it's a lot of interest right now to do this. I took a weekend in Seattle with Dr. Bressler in imagery, you know, in how you use images to control pain. And this is being a lot now, and lots of hospitals have people who will use, you know, patients who have life-threatening diseases and are certainly in pain, where they will go talk with them and try to help them to understand the process instead of taking so much medication, which can really not help the recovery. So we're really coming a long way with this. I really wanted to get into the fact that now we have a mature brain, which is laying on its side, that we should look at what our possibilities are, that God wanted us to be wonderful, wonderful human beings out of all of life's creation. This is the most infinitesimal kind of life form on Earth, and the design of it must have caused him a great deal of real constant whatever. I'm sure he could do anything, but when you find out about the intricate way the brain is created and constructed, it's amazing. And I said before, and I don't think anyone was here, but I held a real brain in my hand in the neuroanatomy class at General Hospital in Los Angeles, which is part of our requirement, and it's just simply matter, you know. It's as one reading I gave was not very attractive, just a kind of a lump, you know, with creases and so forth, and there's no life there. And when you think of energy not being destroyed, it cannot be destroyed, then you realize that this ultra high frequency has gone someplace, and you don't doubt your immortality. I mean, there was no question for me after that class that Jesus hadn't prepared a place for my mother, my father, and the rest of my wonderful people, and for all of us. It's a real positive way to understand our promise. And it really has my interest in helping other people understand what a wonderful gift we have. And in terms of the mature brain, the new research now is that we can develop our brain on through the ages. I mean, there's no way that we cannot keep it growing. And one of the scientists feel now that the reason we have so many folds in the brain, as the older we get, the more we could actually enlarge those folds. The brain, the cap, you know, the skull, fits over the brain, but it does not fit like a glove. It has the space for blood circulation, and there is room for expansion. And when you think how old we are, you know, and our experiences to this time, we can multiply them. The brain, somebody said it was like a muscle. Well, it's many, many, many times more than that. But you have to exercise a muscle, and you have to exercise the brain. And they have classes now where some of the specific things you can do are, if you're whatever your profession, you do something totally different. Like if you've never painted in your life, take a painting class. Or if you have never tried some activity, bowling, or something that is totally different than your own way of life. And that will start more dendrites still growing and more connections in the brain. And that's fabulous, because there are many, many people that have, you know, that are there. I have so many friends, and a lot of my mentors were 75 to 80 years old when I was learning from them. And one of them comes to my center every July. She's now 87 years old. Her name is Magda Gerber, and I knew Magda in Los Angeles before we moved here about 17 years ago. I asked her to speak at a conference for me because she was in that area the leading child specialist, the woman who everybody sought out about infant care. She was trained in Budapest, Hungary, by a medical doctor, Dr. Emmy Pickler, who died several years ago. And Magda and her family came to the United States during the revolution, the Hungarian Revolution. And she came first to Harvard, and because they did not have a program for early childhood, they gave her an honorary doctorate, though. And she came to Los Angeles with her family because in Budapest they had been involved with the movie-making companies. So then her husband became involved with the movie industry, and Magda went up to Stanford University, where she met Dr. Tom Forrest, And he was a neuropediatrician, and he ran a clinic called the Rhys Davis Clinic, which is quite famous on the West Coast. And together, he and Magda worked there for about 2 years in Stanford, but she was flying back and forth to Los Angeles at the weekends, and her husband thought that wasn't too good an idea. So Tom Forrest said, let's go down and establish your center in LA, which he did. And so then she continued the work there. And it's called RIE, R-I-E, stands for Resources for Infant Educators. And RIE has trained people not only in this country, but in Europe. She was asked to go to China 2 years ago and speak to the Chinese medical group there. She'd been to many countries. And fortunately, she comes to Whidbey Island every July. Now that she's the age she is, she comes with a caregiver that's with her, Polly Ferrero. And the last 12 years, she has come to the island for 2 weeks in July to give the training. It's an 80-hour intensive training about the neurological development of infants that she learned in Budapest. And the first week is just lectures. The second week, we take 20 of these teachers and put them in groups of two or three. And they come from Canada and all across the United States. And we send them out to look and observe at daycare centers, infant care centers in Seattle and in Everett and Linwood around our area. They do that one day, and the next day they come back and discuss what they saw. And then the next day they go out again, and this continues. And I buy boxes of Kleenex, you know, lots of them, because when they come back, after hearing Magda lecture for a week, the second week, and they do the observations, they're very distraught. And it's not that the caregivers in many of these infant care centers are not kind, because they are loving, kind people, but they don't understand neurological development, so that they have all the entrapments of the wind-up swings and other things which they care for the infants in this manner. Some infants are put into these daycare centers or these infant centers as early as 3 months, and they're there for 6 hours and seven. One of the centers we always visit in downtown Seattle, it's a wonderful, I won't tell the name of it, but it's a wonderful physical environment. The office building is full of doctors and lawyers and professional people who all have their infants there, cared for well. It's very expensive, but they're still not aware of this developmental process. So then we've trained over 157 teachers this 12th year, and we're all ready to go this July. And Magda's work isn't, the ones that come and learn and understand are, you know, they become advocates of the program, but they go back to their centers where some of the others there haven't been trained, and it's very difficult for them to say, well, we can't use those wind-up swings anymore, and we can't, for one thing that Magda really dwells on, which is the diapering process. When you think how many times you diaper an infant in his diapering time frame, a couple of years, it should be a real time for communication between the caregiver or the mother and the infant. And you don't pick up a baby and say, oh, you're wet, we're going to change you, and put him on the table and change him as fast as you can. You make that a time when you lay the baby down and say, I'm going to make you feel comfortable. I'm going to change you now and explain everything you're doing and have eye-to-eye contact. It's fabulous what they do. But then if you go into centers, you know, I mean, they have, it's supposed to be three infants to every caregiver, but even then it puts them on the, you know, pick the baby up, change the baby quickly, and put the baby down again. So even the ones we train who become so devoted to this philosophy have to go back to where they're, you know, they're, if they are their own directors, which we have quite a few come from different colleges who teach infant care in early childhood, that's a different situation. That makes a difference. And I think half of our people that have been trained have been teachers in the different colleges. But that's a very important place of where we begin communicating with our infant. And if mothers learn this way of communicating, it doesn't stop when they're 1 year old and 2 year old. They listen to the children. Listening to children is something so wonderful. You learn so much from them. And they have ways of explaining, and it might not be the way we could explain something, but it's always fascinating. I guess you heard me last night, mm-hmm. heard the most wonderful thing from my little four-year-old in my program a couple of years ago, who said, "How come you're always in your smile?" And I've never forgotten that. And I think about it, and I want to be in my smile. It's with children particularly, you know, the way she expressed it means something that we don't really think about too much, you know. That's a state of being, and it's really important. Well, I should stop if there are questions before I go on. I'm sorry.
It said about the elderly.
Yeah, that's...
And that's sort of...
Where you're
I'm
at.
I'm not the only one that's sort of in that category.
Okay. I was...
How do we keep the dementia from...
There are really exercises that we can do.
The point you were saying, the
doing different.
The children have developmental.
Yeah.
Right. They've also done some studies that if they tried teaching a language, two languages concurrently with little kids,
they learn
better. Now, if we start learning Japanese now, which I have done.
Have you?
It doesn't work very well.
No.
And I will never be a native speaker.
Mm-mm.
And the same with music. If a child and an adult learn the violin at the same mm-hmm. time, the child will surpass the adult within mm-hmm. weeks and never catch up.
Yeah.
Now, so where is the point in where we do keep our brains going without getting our brains so frustrated?
Particularly because the infant brain has not become set,
and it
has to do with auditory integration, and the sounds are all pliable to their receptivity, where we are conditioned to the culture that we're in. We have heard the sounds of our language. We hear the sounds made by a different language, and they don't resonate like our own sounds.
But now, what can we do as
older than 7-year-olds? Yeah.
To keep our brains going?
Well, it has to do mostly with thinking, and that's the way that we can grow the brain cells. And memory, these are mental skills that we can work on. It's memory, decision-making, flexibility, and creativity. And each one of those, memory, for instance, retaining and recalling facts, figures, and faces, decision-making, make effective and informed judgments, establish goals, priorities, and procedures to do that, and flexibility, the ability to generate abstract ideas from concrete, and vice versa, and to be able to open passageways between dream consciousness and waking consciousness. And these things are all things you can work on. And creativity, ability to invent fresh and imaginative approaches to problem solving and to think in nonlinear ways. Linear is this way, you know, and nonlinear is thinking this way. And it has to do with left-right brain process. I mean, if you're a totally linear person, a lot of people that work in business offices and have to do statistical reports and that... have sometimes lost the ability to think in nonlinear ways. And so to work into those kinds of different ways to get that kind of process together, then we can look at some of these things. And I've done some of these things myself.
Can you start us again with the decision-making, what you establish, and your flexibility and your creativity?
Oh, make effective and informed judgments and establish goals, priorities, and the procedures to do such. And each one of these, decision-making, could have a lot more things underneath it. It's just I gave you titles. But this is one thing that I have used, and I know that it's in some books. I don't know whether I used it first and then read the book or whatever. This is fun to do, too. Write yourself a letter. Write yourself a letter. Don't have it to mail out. Explain why you haven't accomplished something you have planned to do. Maybe you have accomplished it all, but if so, state your fantasies, your ambitions, places you would like to visit, and be sure to put the date on the top of your letter to yourself. And this goes back to energies again. Another name for this in some books would be mind mapping. And it's your mind you're attending to. When you speak a word, there's energy in that word. That word has a form, and it goes out there into the ethers. When you write the word, the thought process from your mind still has an energy form, and you're just putting it back down on paper in the written way, so that there's an energy force there going on. And when you're stating what you haven't accomplished, what you plan to do, where you'd like to go, these are thoughts that are not ordinary thinking that you have to deal with day to day, doing your routine work, whether it's your workspace or home. So that I remember I wrote the letter of why to myself. It was kind of like the book inside of me was talking. Why haven't you written me? I've been waiting to come out. Are you afraid? It's like having a baby. You don't want it to happen because it's been over 9 months now and you still haven't got this book finished. And doing this kind of exercise, it's kind of fun too, and made me realize all the roadblocks I was putting in front of myself. And when I looked at them, I could eliminate them one by one. It took a little time, but I was more able to put them out of my way so that I could get on to do what I wanted to. And it's still using your mind. Another thing that's really fun, going to the Bible again, Adam named all the animals. And that must have been quite a job. Children do a lot of name giving to things that they don't really know the names of, or sometimes things they create in the sandbox or wherever, and they give names to them. This is a very creative act, because in the visual, whatever the object is or whatever they have, and the ability to form a word for that particular thing takes a lot of energy, a lot of creativity, a lot of dendrites that hadn't connected. And that's what you're trying to find. Dendrites that haven't been used before to look at the object or whatever, or a process even. Like somebody came up with mind mapping. I mean, somebody had to invent that. So that every time you do that, you also grow some dendrites. With children, one of the things I tell parents to do too, and grandparents can do it too, because I've done this with my grandchildren when they come back from Alaska or somewhere. They're all over the place. They'll say, "Do you have any new games?" And I'll say, "Well, let's make one." And you get a piece of cardboard. Doesn't have to be real shiny bright, anything that's stable. And you think about, they'll say, "Well, what are we going to use for the markers?" Well, if you have some spools with thread off, and they can paint them. And then you say, "Well, what kind of a game do we want to make?" Well, what would you like to do? And sometimes they'll say, let's go to Disneyland. So you, here's Disneyland, here's home. How are we going to get there? And you have a stream to cross and this and that. But you plan this game out with them. And then we get thinking about, you know, every single game that's in that marketplace, somebody created it. So, hey, this is kind of fun. And then they take them home.
But this may be why Dr. Seuss stayed young so long.
You bet.
He invented names for all kinds of interesting
things. I heard him speak in the Miramar Hotel in Santa Barbara at a writing group. He has the child within himself. He said he'll never get rid of it. You know, he's gone now, but he was a wonderful, wonderful person.
So how much of this senility, which seems to come, is a biological thing, and how much of it is not? I see people my mother's age and above, some of whom are vital, active, fantastic, and the others whose brains are mush.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is there something we can do before the mush sets in?
Of course.
In order to prevent this, or is this an inevitability?
Of course, now, you know, they used to call a lot of the conditions of older citizens senility. Now we know that not all of them, but a part of them were Alzheimer's disease. And now we're finding ways to even combat that. And they're saying that brain exercises that they are now using in care homes for Alzheimer's are really helping them to hold it back and not let it continue, which is wonderful. It's not a cure, but it certainly is a holding place, which is a blessing. Those many people of senior years, advanced senior years, they've had a very active home life or a life that took that they were the responsible people. Sometimes when those things are taken off, or that they are no longer having to be the responsible one, they will kind of regress, and instead of taking up a new activity, they will not do that for some reason or other, and then your brain will, I like to say rust. I mean, it will slow down. It needs exercise. And that's the clue, and that's what we're finding out, that if you do not exercise it, it's just like any other muscle. Mm-hmm. And I feel that many of our, some that I know particularly, had this wonderful responsibility. And then all the children grew up and moved away and don't come back that much. And so the drive to do what they had is not there anymore. And instead of saying, now I am free from that, I will take on going to a children's center and listening to those little voices and reading the songs, I mean, you know, singing the songs and reading the stories. And if that's not it, because I'll tell you, sometimes it isn't it. I worked with Mexican-American mothers in East Los Angeles where they were building, helped get a center built for the children and the mothers. It was a parent education facility. Next to that, they were going to build a home for the grandmother's activities, care center, but not to live there, just to come there. And so the director that we were getting the monies to do this, he said, and possibly those grandmothers will come over and work with the children. Well, that was not the case. These grandmothers had always been home, you know, the style was always that the grandmothers were left with the children. Babysitters were unheard of in this community. The grandmothers had other plans. They wanted to take bus trips to the museums, and they wanted to go to the seashore, and they wanted to do other things. But they were keeping their dendrites growing, even if the patterns that people thought might work did not work. You know, and I'm saying maybe some older people wouldn't want to go to the daycare center to help. They always need help. I did have a family learning center one time, and I hired three grandmothers from the neighborhood to come in and just be with the children when they went to nap time, and I had rocking chairs, and they were thrilled. But I mean, that you don't know what the situation is, and you're not to say, now it's time for you to go to the daycare center. What exciting thing can you think about doing right now? It's a job. I mean, it's a. I think it's a parent's. I shouldn't say responsibility, but it's for love of these people that have given you so much care that we could think about how we could kind of be guides or help them to make some decisions about what could be fun to do. So it's. I have to watch my time. I'm terrible at this. There are so many things to tell you. I don't know how to do it. The only thing, Albert Einstein was never one that slowed down. And people always call him a genius, but he never said he was a genius because he failed academically. And yet his creative mind was like a child, and he never lost that. And he was an amazing human being. He was fun, and people, the young students loved to be around him. If I told you I saw him, you'd know that I'm not as young as I would like to think. I did see him once. But he said this wonderful thing that I think was part of his childlike sensibilities. He was talking about creativity. What this delicate little flower needs most to flourish is freedom. And that's true about how we are with children. Give them the freedom to look at all kinds of life experiences out in the country, and every little, I guess if you read what it said about me, my father would take me on walks, and every five steps we'd stop and turn over a leaf and see what was there, or look at the rainbows in the raindrops, and everything was a miracle. And I think you're all wonderful to come. Next week it's body brain. We're going to do some vision therapy and auditory, how you test your hearing. And I've been kind of waiting to get through the basics so we could do those things. I thank you very much. I want you all to be able to get a seat because there's a big crowd going to Vespers. We stood up last night against the wall. And you were involved. You were wonderful. Yeah.